Standing in a Rainstorm, I Believe. That's I Remember, I Believe, Sweet Honey and the Rock from their CD, Sacred Ground, and that's what we're standing on right now. Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion of ethical concerns blocking patents on embryonic work. Our guests are Mira Lewis and Antonio Regalado, staff reporters for the Wall Street Journal. Antonio is in the studio with us at the landmark firehouse, Engine 31, in the middle of a firestorm. What better place to be? Mira Lewis on the telephone with us from Brussels. Antonio, University of Wisconsin has applied for patents several times. What is the issue and what are they asking for?
This patent relates not to cloning but to the human embryonic stem cell, which has been in the papers a lot. It was discovered first isolated from human embryos in the laboratory at Wisconsin in 1998, and they filed a patent application which was granted to them. So we went to look at that, sort of the history of that patent application. We found that the patent office had initially rejected it, and it was a kind of a curious episode because the main property of these human embryonic stem cells is that they can become basically any other type of tissue. That's their medical promise, that you could make nerves or bone or whatever tissue you liked and be able to treat people with those tissues. But the patent office wanted them to prove that these tissues really could form, or rather the cells really could form any type of human tissue, and the way to do that would have been to implant the cells in an embryo and to show that they could grow to form part or all of the individual that resulted. And the University of Wisconsin argued that that was going to be an experiment that they could never do, that was unethical. And the patent office eventually said, well, you're right. So they gave them the patent.
Can you talk about cloning and how this fits into this controversy?
Right. Cloning is definitely going to be in the news come the fall when the Congress comes back, because earlier in the month, the House of Representatives passed a bill to outlaw all forms of human cloning. But many scientists in the biotechnology industry want to see that ban restricted only to the use of cloning for reproductive purposes, because they see that there are medical benefits possibly to creating cloned embryos. You could take the stem cells from those embryos. So, for example, if they cloned you into an embryo, then they could take the stem cells from that embryo, grow tissues from it, and they would essentially be your tissues sort of rejuvenated. And that could be, a big breakthrough. But the question is, do we want any type of human cloning to be going on in this country or not?
It's interesting. I was just speaking with someone from an Asian Pacific group, and he said that all different groups, African American groups, Asian Pacific groups, different groupings of people are beginning to meet with the NIH as they talk about these kind of issues, now that they've finished the Human Genome Project, to map. And they don't want to deal with the kind of firestorm that they have in the past. And so they're starting to talk to try to make their way. Have you heard anything about this?
I've been hearing that the Genome Project proves that there's no genetic basis for race. We're all 99.9% similar, and so the word out there is that the genome tells us that there are no significant differences between people. So I think that all this type of research does raise these questions, especially for developing nations that don't have access to the technology and that are finding their resources, their genes, patented, basically.
Well, we're going to move on now to talk about how the industries, and talking about the biotech industries, public relations campaigns are stifling debate over biotechnology in a piece by Karen Sharman, who recently won the Project Censored Award for another piece. This is originally appeared in Sierra. It's called Spinning Science into Gold. And I want to thank both of you, Mira Lewis and Antonio Regalado, for being with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Spinning Science into Gold. Karen Sharman is joining us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Karen.
Great to be here.
It's good to have you with us. You start off by saying, when research scientist Arpad Pusztai Pushtai appeared on British television in August 98 to talk about his studies of genetically engineered potatoes. He was suspended and later fired from his job at the Rowett Research Institute in Scotland. After a distinguished 36-year career there, his research was terminated, his data seized, and a contract clause was invoked that put his pension in jeopardy. At that point, the contract became a gag order forbidding him to discuss his work or defend himself in the ensuing 6 months, during which his scientific reputation was trashed by a fierce cadre of pro-biotech scientists in Britain and around the globe. Well, what were the studies of genetically engineered potatoes that he was talking about?
Well, Pushtai is a world authority on a class of plant compounds called lectins, and these compounds have pesticidal properties. So the biotech industry was interested to see if they could use them in the same way that they use Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a natural soil bacterium that has been engineered into a lot of biotech crops to resist insects. And Pushtai initially was pretty excited about this. He wasn't against genetic engineering. He thought that the technology had promise. And what he did was he had three groups of rats that he fed potatoes. One was just fed regular potatoes with nothing added. Another group was fed potatoes that had the lectin added but not spliced into it. And the third group was fed potatoes that had the lectin genetically engineered into it. And what he found in comparing the rats was that it was only the group that had eaten the genetically engineered potatoes that showed disturbing changes in the size and weights of their organs. There were some immune system changes that were very alarming. You know, so he thought, well, what's going on here? You know, it has to be something about the technology itself rather than the thing that was added.
And why was this such a big deal to talk about on British television?
Well, Britain and had just suffered, you know, they went through the whole mad cow thing. So already there was huge distrust of the government and their public agencies that were monitoring food. A lot of biotech products were already on the supermarket shelves. So when he made this revelation, which I should say was with the full support of the Rowett Institute at the time, it was only, you know, when the show aired and then things kind of exploded that, you know, they changed their mind and decided that it wasn't a very good idea. But I think it was that. It was just a spark, and the public there, you know, they had had enough.
Karen Sherman, her piece is Spinning Science into Gold. It's on the TomPaine.com website. We know that the BBC for many years would not air the voices of those involved with the IRA. But this is a new one, although it's not British TV that was stopping Arpad Pushtai from speaking. It was the biotech community. Who were the fiercest in opposing him?
It was just all these scientists, you know, in Britain and here. The chief scientist, I forget the guy's name now, but I mean, over in Europe, there's quite a fierce debate going on within the scientific community, because biotech is kind of a sexy technology in the sense that it's very high tech. You know, there's a lot of money involved in it, and it's kind of the thing to do. So a lot of scientists don't really like, you know, people playing with their toys, basically. And so the chief scientist in Britain, you know, he spoke out and he was trashing Pushtai. And there was a whole thing in the European press about this, you know, for months and months and months. And because he was told that he couldn't speak out or he would lose his pension, you know, he just had to stay silent for about 6 months.
Let's talk about how the biotech industry in this country is trying to, as you put it, spinning science into gold, prevent the kind of fierce anti-biotech movement that there is in Europe here?
Well, they employ a number of techniques. I think for a long time, the government had made a decision a long time ago that biotech, was going to be really important and that the U.S. had to lead it. So there's been a tremendous amount of government support. So initially, when these foods started coming onto the market, except for the genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, which is the hormone that's injected into cows to make them give more milk, other than that, there really wasn't very much press around it. And, you know, the approvals were coming in, and things were pretty quiet, really. But after the controversy in Europe, which has then threatened U.S. markets for biotech products, you know, at that point, the biotech industry thought that, wow, we better, really do something. So what they've done is they're engaged in a public relations campaign. You've probably seen the ads. They're all over the place, ads for golden rice, which is a genetically engineered form of rice. It's not available yet. That has vitamin A added to it, and supposedly it's going to prevent people in third world countries from getting night blindness, because of vitamin A deficiencies. So really what they're doing is they're using arguments like, we need this technology to feed the world, to try and sort of emotionally blackmail people into accepting it. And, they have a lot of access and a lot of allies in the government who help them and do everything that they can, basically, to push through what they want. And they've also got, tremendous allies in the university system, and a lot of biotech money is flowing into the university system. And again, a lot of the contracts that the researchers are forced to sign are very restrictive, so that if something goes awry, like, as did with Arpad Pushtai's research, a lot of researchers, they're forbidden to talk about it.
It's interesting, considering you talk about the survey measuring attitudes toward biotechnology among Cornell University agricultural and nutrition science faculty and extension staff who advise farmers, finding that nearly half have reservations about the health, safety, and environmental impacts of genetically engineered food crops and doubt that they are the answer to global hunger. You talk about Anne Clark, a pasture scientist at the University of Guelph in Canada. What's her story?
Well, what happened to Anne was she and a group of scientists in Canada were very concerned about the speed with which the technology was being introduced and the fact that they didn't think that there was really, much thought being, gone into it, that it was just sort of coming in like a fast train. So they put together a book, and their book raised a lot of questions about the research, and they had a press conference. And, as she said, within 2 hours of the press conference, her dean had called her unethical and, was basically lambasting her for speaking out. And, that only made her more upset. She happens to have tenure, so her job is secure. But, since that time, she's had her lab taken away from her, and initially they wanted to put her and her research assistant down into a room where they had grown, cotton or something like that. But they had worked with plants that were very, very heavily treated with pesticides. So it was a dangerous environment, and she protested that, and, they have since been promised another space. But the space that she's got, her lab space, is one-third the size of her original lab. And, she's continuing to speak out, but she says that, the whole episode has really had a chilling effect on debate within Canada, because people see, what has happened to her, and they don't want to take that chance. I mean, it's not really a very comfortable thing if you speak out and you know that you're the person that is basically sitting in judgment of you, your dean, is going to publicly lambaste you.
Karen Sherman, what about the effect that corporate funding for research, you quote AL Press and Jennifer Washburn's report in the Atlantic Monthly about how university research, corporate funding of university research has increased fivefold, how it affects academic discourse?
Well, you know, again, the contracts that many of the researchers are forced to sign are very, very restrictive. So if they find something in their experiments that is alarming, you know, they can't talk about it. That's one way. Another way is that with such a huge amount...
These are secrecy clauses.
Yes, secrecy clauses.
In academic research, where the whole idea is critical thinking and, you know, students sharing ideas, they now are, what, sort of bound to corporations.
Exactly. You know, I mean, and what happens, too, with that is that where in science things used to be freely shared now, because and it's all because of the ownership, the patents, which is what you were talking about at the beginning of the show, you know, the ownership aspect, it's now intellectual property that's owned by a corporation as opposed to free discourse. So a lot of researchers are finding that they can't get access to research materials that that they used to be able to get access to because now some corporation owns it. You know, so that's one thing that's happened. So, you know, funnily, I think the idea around patents was that it was supposed to give the inventor some protection so that there could be a more free exchange. But ironically, what's happened is that it's actually stifling research in a lot of cases.
Explain what BIO is.
The Biotechnology Industry Organization is the biotech industry's main lobbying organization and also their trade group. They're based in Washington, D.C. They have members in just about every state. They're very geographically diverse. They also have members that are kind of surprising besides biotech companies. They have people like Pete Marwick and some financial houses. In fact, I'm going to get my list here. Let's see. Here we go. The Illinois Department of Agriculture, the New Jersey Economic Development Authority, in addition to, you know, biotech companies. So it kind of shows that everybody is kind of getting in on the act because they see opportunities here. They're extremely well-financed. I mean, some of the dues run as high as $230,000 a year. And basically what BIO does is they are working to make sure that, you know, that the industry pretty much has free rein to introduce its products.
We're talking to Karen Sherman. She has a piece called Spinning Science into Gold, How Industry's Public Relations Campaigns Stifle Debate Over Biotechnology. We were going to go to, after the break, how indigenous people around the world are taking on energy and mining corporations. There's a new book out called Resource Rebels, but I think we're going to put that off till tomorrow because there are so many people you talk about, Karen, in these pieces who are taking on the biotech industry, and you've done another one on nuclear power, and I'd like to continue this discussion. So if you could stay on with us for the rest of the program, I'd appreciate that. We're going to go to break. And then we're going to continue with Karen Sherman. I was out in California just a couple months ago when Karen won, along with Prothop Chatterjee, the Project Censored Award for her reporting on biotechnology. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and we're broadcasting to you from Engine 31 from the Landmark Firehouse in Chinatown, New York. Stay with us.
You're listening to Democracy Now! On KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, or KFCF in Fresno. This is a new Democracy Now! Produced by Amy Goodman and her team at Downtown Community Community Television in New York, not at the studios of Pacifica's WBAI, where the program is usually produced. The Democracy Now! Team has been suspended without pay by Pacifica. Amy Goodman and her producers say they will not return to WBAI until they can be guaranteed a safe working environment. KPFA will continue to bring you Democracy Now! As well as regular updates on the situation surrounding Democracy Now! And the struggle to return Pacifica to its free speech grassroots mission. You can also get more information at the website savepacifica.net. Please stay tuned.
A message from your soul. Feel your life change when your spirit's in control. Listen, oh, listen, oh, listen. I listen to the voice, yeah, that speaks to me each day.
Inner voices, listening to the voices that speak to you each day. Yes, that's Sweet Honey in the Rock from Sacred Ground, where we are today. I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we talk to Karen Sharman, Spinning Science into Gold, How Industry's Public Relations Campaign Stifle Debate Over Biotechnology. Karen, in this piece, you talk about a number of different people who had who run up against the powers that be, in this case, the biotech industry. And not just the industry, it's the people who tout basically the dogma of biotechnology in this country. And among the people you talk about are Sarah Bantz, who is a graduate student in agricultural economics at the University of Missouri. What is she doing?
That she wanted to look at the contracts, the research contracts that were going into the University of Missouri over a 30-year period, and to see, basically if they've become much more restrictive than they were. So in order to get permission to do that, she had to basically swear that she wouldn't release, specifics of anything. So they gagged her.
And what did she end up coming out with?
Well, she wasn't really able to say, except that all she could really tell me was that, pretty much all the research, all the biotech research that's being done is for product development. And when I first talked to her, she said that there wasn't any study looking at the environmental or health and safety effects of biotech. But then, closer to the time that the piece went to press, she called back and said, no, there's one. One that is.
And what is that one?
She couldn't say.
What about organic farmer David Vetter, who is facing off against the biotech boosters as well?
Well, David Vetter is not alone. But David, basically what's happening, and this is, to me, is one of the most interesting aspects. What's happening is that because biotech plants are living organisms, they're part of nature, so they spread. They mutate, they migrate, they grow. You can't recall them back. And what's happening is that a lot of the conventional plants, non-biotech plants and organic plants, they're actually being contaminated by genetically engineered pollen. So, for instance, last year, all of the organic corn samples that were sent in to be tested from the Midwest showed some degree of transgenic contamination. And organic farmers, part of what they guarantee to people is that their products are free of genetically engineered ingredients. They're not genetically engineered. But now they're finding, that this is not a technology that you can fence out. So, you know, like chemical, you know, pesticide drift before it, they're now finding that pollen drift. And also, too, the industry and, you know, the government has done a really terrible job of trying to keep biotech seeds separate. So a lot of the contamination, in addition to wind pollen, you know, may just be seed stock that has gotten mixed in, transgenic seed stock that's gotten mixed in with conventional seed stock.
So David Vetter, an organic farmer from Nebraska, what has 280 acres, he tries to grow all different crops, corn, popcorn, soybeans, barley, variety of grasses, legumes. How does he deal with this issue as he tries to be an organic grower but ends up with transgenic contamination?
Well, so far, his customers have told him that, you know, they'll reluctantly accept a small amount of transgenic contamination because they're, you know, there's nothing that he can do. I mean, he says that really there should just be a ban on genetically engineered crops because it's not a technology that you can fence out. And, you know, his markets, he's made a commitment, you know, to grow a certain kind of food crop. You know, and he does it for, you know, for just very strong, you know, reasons, some spiritual and some, you know, he just believes that this is the way to go and that consumers have a right to have food that is free of, you know, transgenic technology. But, you know, I don't know what he's going to do because as more and more of these crops come online, you know, I think everything could become genetically engineered.
So what is BIO, Biotechnology Industry Organization, that you were talking about doing to make sure that vetters and farmers like him don't get their way in coming up with resolutions to ban biotech crops?
Well, there's a huge controversy going on in the Midwest. Now, there are some states that are proposing legislation because really the next big battleground is going to be wheat, which is supposed to come online commercially 2003. And some states have tried to put moratoriums so that wheat could not be grown because, you know, wheat is another huge commodity crop. And they know that it's going to be contaminated. And because of the, you know, markets overseas rejecting genetically engineered crops, they want to be able to guarantee, because really it's the farmers that suffer, you know, on this, in addition to consumers, of course. But, you know, farmers already are having such a hard time making ends meet. And to do this to them, you know, it's just going to accelerate farmers going out of business. But what BIO has been able to do is politically, since they're so well connected, they can basically make sure that these bills don't go anywhere. And in fact, in March of 2000, I was up at the BIO conference in Boston, and I sat in on their lobbying session, and they were just bragging about how, you know, any of these bills that are introduced, you know, they're not even going to get to the floor. You know, that's basically what they were saying at the time.
It's interesting. At the same time, you have this burgeoning biotech industry in this country. You also have this tremendous growth in the organic foods movement as a, you know, as an industry in this country, as a major force to contend with, I guess, also in reaction to that.
Yeah, and I think that the organic food movement is really, it's the biggest threat that the conventional food system has because it shows that, you know, there is another way of doing things. And I think, you know, I mean, maybe this is really cynical, but I sort of think that the biotech people knew about the contamination issues all along, and now they're just trying to push everything through as fast as they can, and then it'll just be too late. You know, and the reason I say that is at another BIO conference a few years before the one in Boston, there was another pro-biotech scientist who basically said that. you know, that pretty soon everything will be biotech. There won't be any alternative.
Finally, Karen, you have been doing a series of pieces as an investigative journalist who specializes in agriculture, health, and the environment on nuclear power. And in your Tom Paine series, Don't Get Fooled Again, Nuclear Power Still Expensive, Still Dirty, Still Dangerous, one of the ways George Bush was talking about dealing with energy needs in this country was once again reviving the issue of nuclear power. I know, talking about nuclear power reactors on the border with Mexico. But what did you find?
Well, what I tried to do was look at why the idea of pushing nuclear power and building more reactors is a really bad idea. And, you know, gosh, there's so many reasons. I mean, first of all, when you look back at, you know, just from an economic point of view, you know, nuclear technology has been an absolute disaster. And in fact, one of my sources told me that if not for nuclear power, we would not be seeing, you know, the kinds of so-called energy crises that we have, because, you know, it was so expensive that that basically it forced companies who called for deregulation, because they said, we don't want to be locked into paying for this really expensive technology. We want to find something else. And the deregulation, of course, at least in California, the way they did it, was what led to the huge you know, price increases for energy. So it's kind of ironic, but, you know, aside from the economic things, you know, there's the whole issue of what to do with the waste. And, you know, not only the high-level waste, which is the irradiated fuel that comes out of the reactor core, which is deadly for, you know, tens of thousands of years, but even the low-level waste, you know, because when you do, when you create nuclear power, you're basically irradiating everything around it. So now we're finding that as the plants become older and need to be decommissioned, which basically means taken down and supposedly cleaned up, a lot of the parts of the plants, the metals, the concretes, you know, they have low-level radiation contamination in them, and they're recycling them now into consumer goods. Because basically, NRC Chairman Richard Messer last year said if the industry were not able to do that, it would be too expensive for them to operate. You know, so they're just kind of like offloading that cost onto the public. There's the whole issue of operating nuclear power, or operating nuclear power plants just as part of their routine operations. They're constantly emitting radioactive air, or radioactive gases and particles into the air. You know, so there are contamination issues. In terms of the health monitoring, it's practically non-existent. There's a group, the Radiation and Public Health Project, that is trying to actually monitor radiation contamination by looking at children's baby teeth and measuring the strontium-90 content in their teeth to see how much they've been exposed to. And you know, it's just a mess. I mean, it's expensive, it's dirty, it's dangerous. We don't need it.
It's interesting. The Fox anchor Bill O'Reilly has said in May, the American workers really getting smashed, saying later, nuclear power is not an option anymore. It's a must. He calls his program a no-spin zone.
Well...
born perhaps with a nuclear spoon in his mouth. You know, the piece in The Progressive that talked, as you were saying,
yes,
about bringing radioactive waste back into the whole metal flow in this country, recycling it so that we might have it, for example, in our spoons.
Right, or our braces, or our pots and pans, or our cars, or, you know, any any metal product that you can think of because it goes into the scrap metal market.
Well, Karen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Karen Sharman, her pieces appear, among other places, on tompaine.com. And Karen is, a veteran of the WVAI newsroom, and it was great to get to work with you there years ago before you got fully launched on your career. And congratulations on your Project Censored Award. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Thank you to the Pacifica stations. I hope some will hear today's program, particularly KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, and all of our affiliates, with a great shout out today to KGNU listeners. All of that, of course, means all of you. We are Pacifica. Today, we're broadcasting from downtown community television in the historic firehouse Engine 31 in Chinatown. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby. There ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down.